All that night, we crawled southwards, jolting and bumping over the rough ground, often losing the track and having to search for it, shivering in the cold of an African night when the wind blew through the shattered windscreen. In a dawn that was grape purple and smoky blue, I asked Loren to stop the Land Rover. The troopers helped me to dig a shallow grave in the sandy bottom land between two kopjes. I lift it high out of the Land Rover, still wrapped in a dark grey police blanket. He was as light as a sleeping child in my arms. I laid him in the earth, and we stood around in a circle and looked down at him. Blood had soaked through the blanket and dried in a black stain. I nodded at the troopers. All right, cover him. They did it quickly and went back to the Land Rover. It was still cold, and I shivered in my thin cotton shirt. Up on the hill, an old bull baboon barked. His cry boomed across the valley. I followed the troopers back to the Land Rover and climbed up beside them. As we drove on, I looked back and saw a herd of buffalo moving down out of the bush. They were grazing, heads down and tails swinging, towards High's grave. This was where my brother belonged, with the animals in the wilderness he loved. "I'm very much afraid that they've slipped back across the river," the assistant commissioner of police told me. "There's nothing we'd have liked more than to get our hands on this fellow Magiba." We had flown out with MacDonald in the police helicopter to Bulawayo 2 days before. Lauren had left me to help the Rhodesian police as best I could, while he sent for the Lear and went on direct to Johannesburg. Now I was having a final debriefing at police headquarters, while a charter flight stood by to take me back to the City of the Moon. The assistant commissioner was a tall man with a military set to his shoulders and a brush of closely cropped grey hair. His face was seamed and furrowed and burned darkly by a thousand suns. There were ribbons on his chest that I recognized, the emblems of courage and honor. "He's top of our list of the chaps we'd like to meet, actually. Nasty piece of work. But then you'd know that as well as anybody." And he turned those steely grey eyes onto me, giving me the feeling that I was being interrogated. "I know him," I agreed. My part in the hijacking incident was common knowledge. "What do you make of the man?" "He's an intelligent man, and he has a presence. There's something about him I tried to find the words to describe him. He's the type of man who sets out to get what he wants, and the type that other men will follow." "Yes," the assistant commissioner nodded. "That's a fair summation of our own intelligence. Since he joined them, there's been an escalation of hostile activity from our friends across the river." He sighed and massaged his iron-grey temples. "I thought we might have got him this time. They left their dead unbedded and made a run for the river. We could only have missed them by minutes." He walked on with me to where a police car waited under the jacaranda trees with their clouds of purple blossom. "What news have you of MacDonald?" I asked as we stood beside the police car. "He'll be all right. They saved both legs." "I'm glad." "Yes," agreed the police commissioner. "He's a good type. Wish we had more of them. By the way, Doctor, we'd rather you kept mum about this business. We don't like to make too much fuss about these incidents. Rather playing into their hands, you know. Give them the publicity they want." We shook hands and he turned and strode back into the building. As we drove through the busy streets and I saw the smiles on the faces around me, I wondered why anybody should want to destroy this society. And if they succeeded, with what would they replace it? It seemed natural then to think of the City of the Moon. A great civilization, a nation which held dominion over an area the size of Europe, a people who built great cities of stone and sent their ships in trade to the limits of the known world. All that remained of them were the poor relics which we had so laboriously gleaned. No other continent was so fickle in the succor it gave to men, to raise them up so swiftly and then to pluck them down and devour them, so that they were denied even a place in her memory. A cruel land, a savage and merciless land. It was a wonder that so many of us loved her so deeply. My return to the City of the Moon was disappointing. After the events of the last few days, it was an anticlimax. It seemed that the others had hardly noticed my absence. "Did you enjoy yourself?" Sally asked over the typewriter and a pile of translation sheets. "Well, it was interesting." "Oh, that's good. What happened to your eyelashes?" she asked, and without waiting for an answer began pounding the keyboard with two fingers, biting her tongue with concentration, pausing only to push her hair off her cheek with the back of one hand. "Glad you're back, Ben," said Eldridge Hamilton. "I've been wanting to talk to you about this." And he led me to a table on which a portion of one of the scrolls was spread. I didn't seem able to concentrate. Suddenly, for the first time in my life, I felt that it was ancient and unimportant, compared with the blood that I so recently had seen spurt fresh and red. Ral and Leslie had obviously used my absence to scheme out an approach. Ral spoke for both of them, with Leslie prompting him when he faltered. "So you see, Doctor, we don't feel it's right to marry until at least one of us has a steady job. So, well, we thought we'd sort of ask your advice. I mean, we love it here, both of us. We'd like to stay on. But we'd also like to get married. It's just that, well, we've got such a high opinion of you, Doctor. We wouldn't like to miss the rest of the investigation, but..." I spoke to Lauren that evening and then called them from the supper table. "The job is worth 3,500, and Leslie will get 2. Of course, there's a free flat at the Institute, and I'll help you with the furnishing as a wedding present." Leslie kissed Ral and then me. A novel way in which to accept the offer of employment, I felt. Ral threw himself into the search of the cliffs with renewed energy. But I spent little time with him. Instead, I began to prepare my address to the Royal Geographical Society. This should have been a labor of love and excitement, but I found myself floundering. There was so much detail in the scrolls, but all of it seemed irrelevant to those unanswerable questions. Where did they come from, and when? Where did they go to, and why? Each time, my efforts became so long-winded and convoluted that they bored even me. Then I would rip the sheets from my typewriter, ball them up, and hurl them at the wall. There is no more lonely place in the world than a blank sheet of paper. And it frightened me that my unruly emotions should intrude and prevent me marshalling my thoughts and facts in orderly ranks. I tell myself that it was reaction from the horrors of our journey to the north, that Sally's enigmatic behavior was worrying me deeply, that it was merely the fear of the imminent confrontation with my enemies. I tried all the tricks, forcing myself to sit at the typewriter until I'd completed 10,000 words, or rising at midnight to try and shake loose a flow of words from my stalled brain. The address remained unwritten, and I found myself mooning about my office, polishing the great battle axe until it gleamed and glittered, painful to the eye, or strumming fitfully on my guitar, and composing new songs, which all seemed sad and mournful. At other times I would sit for hours before the painting of the White King, dreaming and withdrawn. Or I would wander all day along the cliffs, oblivious of the sun and the heat, and it seemed that often a little bird-like presence was near me, moving like a mischievous brown sprite, just beyond the fringe of my vision. Or again I would sit alone in the dim depth of the archives, deep in a trance of despair, as I remembered the hatred in Timothy's smoky eyes as he glared at me across the watercourse where the dead men lay. Neither Timothy nor I were all of what we seemed to be. There were dark and ugly depths in both of us. I remembered the savagely mauled bodies of the tiny bushmen left lying for the birds, and my own screaming madness as I cut down the running men on the white sand of the riverbed. I don't know how long my despondency might have lasted, except for the discovery which uncovered the answer to so many of the mysteries that still enshrouded our city. Eldridge's team had been countering my apathy by an accelerated advance through the scrolls. Practice had sharpened Sally's grasp of the language until she was as quick and as fluent as Eldridge himself. Even Leslie was now able to make an appreciable contribution to the work, while Eldridge had arrived by a process of trial and error at the most suitable method of unrolling and preserving our scrolls, and he was now saving a great deal of time in this procedure. At breakfast, which seemed to be the only time we spent together these days, Eldridge asked me to resume the work of removing the pottery jars from the archives. To be truthful, I welcomed the excuse not to have to face the blank, accusing stare of a sheet of paper in my typewriter, and Ral seemed as pleased to have a change from his fruitless search of the cliffs. In the cool, peaceful gloom of the archives, we worked in our established routine, photographing and marking the position of each jar after we'd labeled it and entered it in the master notebook. The work was unexacting, and Ral did most of the talking, for my mood of lethargy still persisted. Ral lifted down another of the jars from its slab. And then he peered curiously into the space beyond, where the wall opened into a square stone cupboard. "Hello," Ral exclaimed. "What's this?" And I felt my lethargy fall away like a discarded article of clothing. I hurried across to him, and I had a feeling of pre-knowledge as I stared at the row of smaller, squatter jars of the same pottery which had been hidden away in this carefully prepared recess. I knew that we had made another major advance, a significant step forward in our search for the ancient secrets. This idea came into my mind fully formed. It was as though I'd simply mislaid these small jars, and now I'd rediscovered them. Ral moved the arc light to obtain a better lighting of the recess, and immediately we noticed another unusual feature. Each of the jars that we could see were sealed. A loop of plaited gold wire linked the lid and body of the jar, and a clay seal bore the imprinted figure of a bird. I leaned forward and gently blew away the dust that obscured the impression on the seal. It was of the crouching vulture, the classical soapstone bird of the Zimbabwe culture, with its base of sun disks and rays. It came as a distinct shock to find this emblem of modern Rhodesia upon a seal of indisputably Punic origin 2,000 years old, as it would be to find the lion and unicorn of the British coat of arms in an Egyptian tomb of the 20th dynasty. We worked as quickly as was reconcilable with accuracy, labelling and photographing the large jars which obscured the recess, and when we lifted them down, we discovered that there were 5 of the smaller jars concealed behind them. All this time, my excitement had been increasing, my hope of a major discovery becoming more certain. The concealment of the jars and the seals indicated their importance. It was as though I'd been marking time, waiting for these jars, and my spirits surged. When finally we were ready to remove them from the recess, I reserved this honor for myself, despite Ral's protests of, "But I found them." Balancing on the top rungs of the stepladder, I reached in and attempted to lift the first of them. "It's stuck," I said, as the jar sat immovably on its slab of stone. "They must have bolted it down." And I leaned further into the recess and carefully groped behind the jar for the fixings which held it in place. I was surprised to find that there were none. "Try one of the others," Ral suggested, breathing heavily on the back of my neck from his lofty perch on top of those lanky legs. "Can I give you a hand?" "Look, Ral, if you don't give me a bit of room, you're going to suffocate me." "Sorry, Doc," he muttered, and he moved back a full quarter of an inch. I tried the next jar and found that it was also solidly anchored to the shelf, as were the next 3. "That's very odd." Ral understated the position, and I returned to the first jar, and bracing my elbows on the edge of the shelf, I began to twist it in an anti-clockwise direction. It required my full strength, and the muscles bulged and knotted in my forearms before the jar moved. It slid towards me an inch, and immediately I realized that the jar was held down on the slab, not by bolts, but by its own immense weight. It was 50 times heavier than the jar's twice its size. "Ral," I said, "you're going to give me a hand after all." Between us, we moved the jar to the front edge of the shelf, and then I cradled it in my arms like a newborn infant and lifted it down. Later, we found that it weighed 122 pounds avoirdupois, and it wasn't much bigger than a magnum of champagne. Gently, Ral helped me to settle it into the fiberglass cradle we'd designed for transporting the jars. We each took a handle and carried it down the archives, out through the access tunnel, and past the guard post at the entrance. I was surprised to find it was already dark, and the stars were pricks of light in the high opening above the emerald pool. Our disparity of heights made it awkward carrying the cradle, but we hurried down the rock passage and down towards the camp. I was relieved to see that lights still burnt in the repository. When Ral and I carried in our precious burden, the others hardly glanced up from their work.